The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
In the recorded teachings of Master Zhaozhou, there's a story of on the road to Taishan, Mount Taishan, the great sacred mountain, lived a certain woman. Whenever a student asked her, which way does the road to Taishan go? The woman would say, right straight on. And as soon as the monastic would go, the woman would say, a fine priest, they too go on that way. A student told Master Zhaozhou about this, and Zhaozhou said, wait till I check out this woman for you. Zhaozhou also asked the woman the same question and received the same answer. The next day, he went up to the hall and said, I have thoroughly seen through the woman for you. Now, this is a koan both in the Woman Koan and the Book of Serenity, but I want to work with it a little bit differently and really concentrate on this woman, this certain woman of Mount Taishan. Yesterday, I spoke about the relative truth, this really important teaching of Buddhism of the two truths. The relative truth, which is in Buddhism, the world that we perceive with our senses, the world that we confuse in our mind and objectify and impute all kinds of attributes and inherencies and permanence that it doesn't actually possess. And the ultimate truth, which is the realization of emptiness of Buddha nature, of the real nature of things, which is unhindered and vast and free and uncorruptible because it's not a thing, it can't be possessed, it's never lost, it's never gained, it's not born or never dies. And I read from a passage from a book by Marcus Borg on, he's writing about Jesus and who that historical religious person was, figure was, before he became something more through the church. And he talked about what he called conventional wisdom. And I was sort of borrowing on, drawing on what he said to talk about relative truth from our own perspective. And I just want to recap some of the things he spoke about. He spoke about the social construction of reality, conventional wisdom, relative truth, and the internalization of that construction into our minds, into our, what we call our psychology, our beings. He called it enculturated consciousness. And that relative truth, this conventional wisdom, lays out what life is, how it works, how we're supposed to work within it, what the rules are, what the values are, how to be successful, that it's a world of hierarchies and boundaries where if you do the right thing, you'll get what you want. You'll get the right stuff. If you don't, then it's pretty much your fault for not doing the right thing. So he described it as oftentimes a harsh and grim world, a life of bondage to that culture, of limited vision and blindness. We see what this enculturated consciousness teaches us to see, we consider important, what it teaches us is important, and the rest. And he's described it as a life according to a performance principle, that everything depends on how well we perform. And these are very broad statements. I talked about that a little bit yesterday. And that really what we're talking about is what lives within every person. So each person is, in a sense, a universe, a world that looks out upon the world. And then those worlds come together and create a sort of a collective world. We call it a sangha, we call it a family, we call it a company or an organization, a government, and so on. And then views and values and what's important and not important, what's rewarded and what's punished, is brought forth within those various bodies. And those individuals create karma, and those bodies create karma, in a sense, collectively, and impact the world. And we're all in it, right? Can't opt out. And so some of us are in it, in a sense, with our eyes closed. We don't see it. It's kind of like advertising. You see it and you don't even know why you're going up to the fridge to get that ice cream, right? You're not actually hungry, but there you go, right? And some of us are in it with one eye open or an eye partially opened. Some of it have our eyes open and we're still in it and still caught, and so on. There's a spectrum. And it would be easy to see as we see this, and oftentimes it happens, that when we see this in kind of the, not just the controlling, the dominating aspects, but the harsh aspects, the grim aspects, and all the suffering that such worlds create. And I mentioned yesterday that, you know, this is how we grow up in the world. It's the ethos of our various bodies of family and community and religions and so on, and that, of course, it's not all bad. We learn lots of important lessons. We learn lots of important things about how to be in the world that do make it possible for us to be in the world. So it's not that it's by any means all bad. But when we see the more negative aspects of it, the controlling aspects, the manipulative aspects that are not about your well-being or our well-being, it's easy to go to the other side, to just, well, I'm just going to follow my own desires. Screw that. To trust rarely, cautiously, to resist, to hate authority, to hate hierarchy, to want to isolate, to fight, to destroy. And of course, there are many, many examples of that everywhere. Or to isolate, to retreat, to give up. You know, I've talked about my friend in college who had a button that said 95% of everything is shit. And that was kind of his credo. You know, and he was like a really lovely person in many ways, very smart. But, you know, that's the way he saw the world. And I kept saying, Steve, I don't think this is going to work out well for you. I don't see how it's going to work out well. And he said, it won't. Because 95% of everything is shit. Well, it's, you've worked it out, but not in your favor. And so the lessons from that can be hard, you know. We open ourselves up and we love, and then our hearts are broken. Then it's like, okay, I guess the lesson is don't ever love again. Don't ever open that heart up again. Don't let yourself be vulnerable, right? Or harbor anger, resentment. Be angry, right? But the Buddha said all of that is just being confined to some conventional wisdom, to some relative truth, to some view. And he said, meanwhile, none of this has any absolute truth. None of this has any basis on its own. That when we talk about truth in Dharma, we should know we're in sort of a tricky terrain there. Because truth conveys the sense of a truth. Truth. It exists by itself. That's what makes it truth, right? And that the nature of truth is that it's true all the way through. And that if you look into it, you will find truth. A thing. The Buddha didn't teach that. He didn't talk that way. What he actually said was that that's an illusion, and that in every moment, everything is born and dies. Everything appears and disappears too fast for us to see. Everything is just that. That is the world. That is human life. That is what is happening. And when we try to, as Borg says, try to domesticate reality, make it fit into a neat box because that seems safer or more trustworthy or just more manageable, or reduce everything to a slogan, and we see how attractive that is, how easy it is to be pulled in or pull others into that. He said that cannot be a path of success if what we're striving for is actually a free life, a compassionate life, a life that is actually living in accord with the way things are. And so we train. We take it up. We do what is difficult to do, which is to examine, knowing that in a sense we're putting everything at risk, right? All of those safe assurances and longed for promises and guarantees. But in our mind, the alternative, I mean, that where the path that's led, that may be, seem to be leading to is like chaos, right? Or confusion, or, you know, mayhem. No, that's like where we're coming from. Variations on those themes. That what we're moving towards is this, what's already here. And so this certain woman who lived on Mount Taishan, who served tea, whenever a monastic would come by on pilgrimage to make their way up to the sacred mountain, and they would ask, is this the road to Mount Taishan? And she would say, just go straight ahead. Simple question, simple answer. And off they would go, and she would say, fine priests, but they go that way too. And so in the koan, Zhaozhou gets involved and goes to check out the old woman, comes back and says, I have seen through the old woman. And of course, that's the koan. What did he see? And the koan really centers around Taishan. And I want to focus on this certain woman. And because of the way she appears in the koan, she has no name, no position. She serves tea. In a sense, she just becomes a sort of a vehicle for Zhaozhou to teach and cause some trouble. So we have no details about her. The koan doesn't really center on her. And is that because she's a woman? Is it because she's a person without any title? It's because she's not a monastic. She has no rank or position compared to Zhaozhou, who was, in fact, a great master, abbot of his monastery, lived essentially a century, imagine that, a century in the Dharma. I mean, you know, I would like to have a little bit of time with him. But I see these both as masters, both as teachers, both as guiding people along the way, both essentially as practitioners, actualizing the way from their own places. Now, the koan doesn't tell us that. All we know is that she asks this question. And so you might say, well, aren't I projecting into it? Yes, I am. Because if I don't, then she just remains a certain woman. And once she's said her piece, she has no role anymore. There's no reason to inquire further about this certain woman, about what did she say? What was her mind? What was her intention? What was her power? She's a tea woman offering refreshment to travelers. Zhaozhou, you could from one perspective say, is a great master, he's an abbot of a monastery, leader of students, known within the Chan world. We speak of him still. We could also look at him as being somewhat burdened by those things. You know, there are stories of on the night before somebody was going to be installed as the abbot, some great monastery, next morning, nobody can find them. They're gone. John talks about it quite unabashedly as the iron yoke. This tea woman has no such burden. She is free without rank and high position. She has no institution. She stands alone on this mountain as a mountain, a bodhisattva immersed in the world. When Jimon and I were in Korea many years ago, we climbed one of the sacred mountains of Korea. And we were just going through the woods, having a lovely walk, and lo and behold, there was a certain woman serving tea. I was like, oh my God. It happens. This is it. This is the moment. to ask all those unanswered questions. And there is that long, really exquisite relationship in our tradition with the mountain. The recognition of the mountain as a sacred being, and of going to that mountain to practice, to seek. That's why for Dadaroshi it was so important, this place. It wasn't just the magnificence of the building, which is perhaps inarguable, but that it was here at the foot of this mountain and these two rivers crossing, which is an auspicious location, a place of spiritual power. And that there was that meant that we would have the opportunity to practice and build and create this Buddha field within and upon and as one of with this mountain, this sacred mountain, and the auspiciousness of that. There's in the Theragata, the collection of poems by Buddhist nuns at the time of the Buddha. There's one of the nuns, Matika, who was born to a wealthy family. She met the Buddha and was raised bodhicitta, hearing his teaching, and she left home, was ordained by Mahapajapati, and she went to the mountain to practice, and she lived there into her old age. And she wrote a poem. Even though I am suffering and weak and my youth is gone, still I go on, leaning on my stick, climbing the mountain. I threw off my outer robe and turned my bowl over. I sit on a rock, my heart is freed. The three things that most people don't know are now mine. What the Buddha taught is done. The Buddha would say when somebody had realized himself, he would say, this person has done what needs to be done. And I've always loved that, so simple, so succinct. To do what must be done. The three things that most don't know are I think they're what the Buddha realized in his enlightenment, because there were three watches of the night and three realizations that he had. One is to see into our past lives. One is to see into the nature of karma. And the third is presented here, is to know one's own moral corruptions, everything that holds one back. The Buddha, it was dependent origination in the Four Noble Truths. But to think about a monastic encountering a teacher like Zhaozhou, like this great, august master, and to go into and meet this person, and that we will inevitably carry in our expectations and our ideas and maybe our anxiety, our fears, our hopes, hoping to encounter the Dharma, to receive a teaching, to enlighten our mind, and how all of that could help us, could help that student, or can hinder them. Both are quite possible. Going in that way could make us alert and open. It could also bring in lots of expectations and cause us to actually miss what's actually going on. Meeting this certain woman on the road, right, without all of those outer trappings, right? Still, we can go in with expectations and ideas and biases and will almost inevitably. We don't expect to have a Dharma encounter. We don't expect anything significant to happen other than getting a cup of tea. That's it. And how that could open our minds when something unexpected happens, or it could close our minds so that we actually miss something that just happened. And so the teaching that we should experience all experiences, all sounds, all sights as dharmas, that we should encounter all people as Buddhas, not only having Buddha nature, but actually conveying dharma. And sometimes they do that by providing a very illuminating example of an enlightened quality or enlightened action or enlightened or compassion. And sometimes they do that by presenting a hell realm, showing up as a demon, or bringing hell into our lives. Because when we encounter things that way, just think about it, right? If you really cultivate that. And so is that a kind of projection? Yeah, It is. But what is the projection that's already there?
Right.
Because it's not like we're just adding, bringing in a projection to a clean slate, right? We have the potential to bring in something new where there's already lots already loaded up. And how's that been working? And so since we are using our mind to create, to see, have an experience, see an image, see a person, have an idea, see them in a particular way, we can see them in this way, that's my mind. I can see them in this way, that's my mind. In a way, that's what the koans are doing. One after the next, after the next, after the next. I remember when I was working on koans early in my training, I thought, well, you know, like, what's really going on here? Like, because, you know, I'm sitting here in the Zendo and, you know, I'm taking this situation that's like not real and I'm bringing it into my mind and trying to make it real, right? And I thought, well, that's kind of like a projection. It's like I'm doing that with my mind. Exactly. What was I doing with my mind just before that? Right? And so since I am doing this with my mind, and what I have been doing has really not been working out so well, right? And the sort of the stuff that I've been using, the things that I've been drawing upon, the views, the desires, the intentions, right? The sort of the material with which I'm drawing to create these images, to project these ideas, right, based in certain concepts and worldviews that really don't seem to be in alignment with the way things are working because evidence A. And listening to these masters speak as though they have gone to some place within themselves that no one created, is not the result of an ideology, is not their like marketing plan, right? Is not their way to be somebody. It's not to get something from me. I brought myself here. And that there is this consistency of voice, even outside the Buddhist tradition, with other people who have seemed to have journeyed to some place within themselves, and they speak in some common language, or even using different languages of a common experience? Like, what is going on? And so what if, with some measure of faith, I release some of my conviction about the way things are, and I enter into, with my mind, a world so that I can ask a question, so that I can engage in this moment. What is the way to Mount Taishan? I want to know. I do. I want to know. What is that way? So I'm listening, because that question is my question. And she says, go straight ahead. Okay, I can do that. And then I do that. And she goes, cluck, cluck, cluck. There's another one that just goes on the same way. Now what happens? Now what happens? I could just continue on. What is she talking about? What is she mumbling about? Or I could stop. What? What did you say? Who are you? What did you mean? The Buddha said in the Dhammapada, you are your own protector. You are your own refuge. The skillful become their own protectors and attain their aims. You know, this is so important, and it can sound very sort of isolating. You know, like, you're on your own. Rot's a ruck, right? And in a sense, yeah, you are. And isn't it glorious that each of us is on our own, and here we are, traveling in solitude together. Traveling this path alone, together. And so being my own protector, being my own refuge, what do I do with this encounter? how do I see this certain woman? What is the way to Taishan? She seems to be offering assistance. Why does she speak this way? The teachings, you know, if we think of this teaching of the two truths, the teachings can always be seen that way. They can be always seen as speaking on the relative because they're just using ordinary language. What is the way to Mount Taishan? Go straight ahead. Seems very clear. And at the same time, they can be seen as speaking on the ultimate. Both are happening at the same time because it is non-dual, because the way is one way. And that's what makes the teachings, particularly in these kinds of teachings, right, that are not didactic, they're not spelling it out for you, they're not giving you instructions. Rather, they're inviting you in to the thing that only you can do because you are the one. And so there is some instruction, go straight ahead. But is that all she meant? What is go straight ahead? When Dogen said, sitting in the meditation posture is a straightforward, straight-ahead body, a straight-ahead mind, a straight-ahead body-mind, a straight-ahead Buddha ancestor, a straight-ahead practice realization, a straight-ahead top of the head, and a straight-ahead life stream. Suddenly, go straight ahead seems somewhat larger, somewhat more needing of inquiry. What is this straight ahead? Such that when the student just simply goes straight ahead, one foot in front of the other, following the finger pointing, she responds this way, as though you're missing something. I'm missing something. What am I missing? Dogen says, when the Dharma does not fill our body-mind, then we think we have enough. So it would be very easy for this master to think, I'm a monk, right? I'm the religious here. I'm studying the Dharma. I know what I'm doing. She's a tea woman. What are you talking about? Not really my concern. When the Dharma does not fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. When the Dharma fills our body and mind, then we realize something's missing. How exquisite. Then we realize something is missing. That the more we practice and the closer we get, the more we see what we do not know. And we don't see what we do not know, but we know we do not know. How do we know that? Because the way is vast and limitless. And because we see in our own lives, in our own thoughts, how what is complete is not complete. How what is perfect is not perfect. How what is realized is not actualized. How what is intended is not actually lived. There's a poem by two different female Chan masters, 17th century Chinese masters, who studied with another master. And they both commented on this koan, on this teaching. And one of them, whose name is Bao Qi, said, when Zhao Zhou's eyeballs shoot forth a light, the old woman's brows are thrown to the ground. Although each appears to have sealed the border, in the end, neither one is able to get themselves out. Let's sit leisurely on top of the mountain peak and watch as the one falls and the other rises. When the sacred mountain reaches everywhere, when going straight ahead is taking not a single step, then where's the border? Are you inside of it or are you outside of it? Having sealed the border, neither one is able to get themselves out. So why not just sit at leisure on top of the mountain and watch as one falls and the other rises? Let's watch as birth and death, appearing and disappearing, take place moment after moment within these two masters of the Dharma. No longer deceived, no longer afraid, no longer seeking the mountain somewhere. Her Dharma sister, a master named Zukui, also wrote a poem, the ending of which says, pointing it out, all becomes clear, nothing to be done. In great peace, grasses and trees exhaust the weapons of war. The general with a single arrow pierces the three barriers. The sun and moon, both round, beat out a joyful melody. In great peace, grasses and trees exhaust the weapons of war. Grasses and trees are the 10,000 things. Grass is often referred to as delusion, the things that bind us. They exhaust the weapons of war, the weapons of our delusion, of our pain and suffering. You know, how do we know that we all possess Buddha nature? Well, the Dharma teaches that the way we know is because you are here. That without Buddha nature, without already possessing the enlightened nature, we would never give rise to bodhicitta. That just wouldn't occur. If there wasn't already within us an impulse, a sense, a seed, an energy, a force, a truth, that we are that nature, that we are free and unfettered, that we are not divided, that the idea, the possibility that we could realize, live, experience that would never take root. That the Buddha would never have left home. He might have come to the same conclusions that he did, that this life was not a life of that he was seeking, but in a sense, there would be nothing to be done. So many steps we take to arrive to the place from which we've never departed. But we have to do that. We have to actually seek that mountain. We have to struggle with suffering that has no root. We have to bring forth and cultivate compassion, which has no location. Zhaozhou spent his life serving within a monastery. The master of tea served from a tea house on a mountain, and who knows how and where else she served. Free of robes and titles, monastic rules and obligations, a free and solitary bodhisattva, serving the tea of disruption and doubt. And so in tribute to her, I will offer a few words. On the road to Mount Taishan, a tea dragon serves illness and medicine for the well-being of the thirsty traveler. Please don't be deceived by her humble appearance. She has the power to change a life in an instant. Don't feel the need to adorn her humble appearance. She is majestic and noble, just as she is. Can you hear? O person of the way, which road will you take to the great and calling mountain?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.